Greetings all, what is the good word? Thank you for stopping the scroll and spending some of your valuable time with us. This is the Coptimizer podcast, and I'm your host, Patrick Flannelly, retired chief of police and all-around wannabe renaissance man. Here we look to spend some time with leaders and pioneers that have a passion for public safety and those who look to build strong and resilient individuals and organizational cultures, both of which result in stronger communities. We look across industries with a focus on peak performance. Our biggest questions, what can I do to squeeze every little drop of life out of each day? How do I get a little bit better today than I was yesterday? And how can I tap into the energy that makes it all possible? While our focus is on first responders and those in public service, the lessons shared here on the Coptimizer podcast are universal. Our goal is to hire healthy, retire healthy, and maximize impact in our personal and professional lives in that time in between. To drive value and squeeze every drop out of our performance so we can be awesome for our families, our departments, and our communities. Better performing officers make for better performing organizations. This is not a complicated truth. It is the simple truth. From the top cop to the street cop and all those working in support of high-performing organizations, this show is for you. It's time to Coptimize. Good evening, Major Randall Anderson.
How you doing, Chief?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for spending a little time with us on the Coptimizer podcast. Been looking forward to this recording and learning a little bit more about you and how things are going down in South Florida. I'm up here in the lovely Midwest.
We're 85 to 90, like always, and sunny.
Sunny always. You're like San Diego, right? It's like, who doesn't want to be there? I tell you what, I'll be calling you in December saying, can you hook a brother up, man? I'm ready to go someplace warm because the older I get, the colder winter gets.
But anytime you're ready, you come on down.
But that's great, man. Hey, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about policing in South Florida. And let's start maybe a little bit about you and how you got your start in policing and what you're doing these days.
I work in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. It's a community with about 60,000 residents. We can go up over 100,000 during the daytime. There's several malls and shopping and close to the beach. Lots of golf courses, obviously. We host the Honda Classic. We've got an amazing, real supportive community that supports us. We were just laughing about it the other day. A lot of time we go out to lunch and people pay for our meals, you know, and you're like, oh no, we can't do that with gratuity and everything. But we actually had two people arguing over who's going to pay for our meals.
Always a nice feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. The community really supports us on everything that's going on in law enforcement. Sometimes we have to look in the mirror and realize how lucky we are compared to other parts in the country, you know?
Well, that's better than the cheeseburger for a cop.
That's it. Yeah. We actually,
we all like the joke about that, but we know
we hired hired a guy from Chicago about a year ago, and he wouldn't leave to go out to lunch. And we said, what are you doing? Why? And he goes, well, you know, the precinct that I was in, we didn't go out to lunch because we weren't treated real great in the area that I was in. And we said, come on, you got to start going out to lunch. And you could just see the difference in his experience as an officer out on the street, you know, compared to us. But
I
moved to Florida in 2003. I grew up in New York. I had a single mom. And I actually got into law enforcement when I was about 17 years old. I was arrested. And that was one of the things that made me always want to become a cop. It sounds a little bit crazy, but as a part of my community service, I had to do 100 hours in a boxing gym. And I was around cops and I saw how they were, and they disciplined and mentored me and filled a void that I was probably lacking at home with my mother. And I started really thinking positive about law enforcement. And I knew that as I got older and after college that I'd want to get into law enforcement. So that's how I focused in on it. Moved to South Florida, got into law enforcement, moved through the ranks pretty quick, went from patrol to FTO, field training officer, SWAT, got onto a Marshals task force, and got to experience working all over South Florida, which is awesome. A lot of law enforcement officers get to travel outside of their jurisdiction, and my department was awesome in that respect. Being that most of our crimes are done by people that don't live in the city, it allowed us to go outside of our city and apprehend people, which was great. It was a win-win, probably from my experience, but also for the department.
So crime is transient.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, crime travels.
So let's back up just a second. So you're 17, you get yourself into a little bit of trouble. And I think it's important to touch on this just a little bit, because in this day and age where we're having across the country big struggles, recruitment and retention, bringing quality people into policing, I think there is often a misunderstanding especially amongst young people, that if you've ever gotten yourself into trouble, that you could never become a police officer. And certainly there are some things that you could do that are probably going to disqualify you for life. You're never going to get an opportunity. But misdemeanor drug crimes, fighting, certain things, especially when you're young, they don't disqualify you. But what they do, and it sounds like maybe this is the experience that you had, is they can awaken something within an individual that they didn't know that was there. And those are lessons that they can bring with them into the career of policing. Yeah. We'll hire a 21-year-old, but we prefer to hire a 25-year-old or a 28-year-old. It's not to say that any one of them, everybody is just a little bit different, but when you come to this profession with more life experience, you're more relatable. And there are things that you can share and you can apply that, the old saying is, you don't know what you don't know. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think, man, you hit the nail right on the head. I think being arrested years later, now that I'm in law enforcement, I have compassion, not only towards everybody, but for the person that I do take into custody on an arrest, because everybody's a person and everybody has a bad night. And sometimes that doesn't mean they're a bad person. Everybody has a story. And I've just treated everybody fair and just always do what's right. And that night that I let my mother down, that I got arrested like that, I'll never forget as long as I live. And I think that pain allowed me to form some greatness out of it. And I took something good out of it. And I think it makes me a better officer for sure. And a better leader as well. Pass that on to some of the younger officers. And, the diversion programs that law enforcement has, that if you're a young guy out there and you did get in trouble, there's a good chance that you'll be able to do community service or to get judged by your peers and get a lesser charge or get an adjudication withheld. And, it sometimes you can take something good out of something bad.
And you touched on it, but what did the judge make you do?
Well, he gave me 100 hours community service because I was arrested for fighting, and thought it would be a great idea to send me to the police athletic league boxing gym for 100 hours. And it actually was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it definitely humbled me and taught me that it's not fun to fight, especially with people that know how to fight. And it just taught me everything about fitness and the importance about discipline and being on time and showing up. And it changed my view of law enforcement. And just really, I really looked up to those guys as mentors, and I still keep in touch with some of them still today.
It's such a powerful story. And there's so many lessons there. The Police Athletic League and the work that they do. And, not everybody grows up in the same environment. People don't grow up with the same opportunities. They don't grow up in dual parent households. Everybody's battling something, right? They bring that with them. So to have an opportunity to spend some time with police officers outside of them being in uniform, you get the opportunity to build relationships and learn that, wow, okay, police officers are people too.
I saw them doing things that regular society doesn't advertise that law enforcement does probably regularly. I'd see some of the guys, they get off of work and they're volunteering their time, training youth in a sport that takes a lot of discipline. But not only are they doing that, they're taking a homeless guy that hangs around the gym and they're bringing him inside and making him clean up, and they're giving him $20, or they're giving him a meal, or they're letting him come in because it's cold out, and they're showing compassion to people. And in return, that guy may tell him who's doing something out there or give them information and share with them. And I just saw a whole different side to law enforcement. We always hear about the bad side of law enforcement. We don't always hear about all the good things. Don't always make the best news, unfortunately.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, we're in the information business. That's what we do. Yeah. We collect information. If you don't collect good information, you're not going to be very effective. You know, you can be busy, but maybe not effective. That was one of those lessons I learned the hard way. I got to see a lot of really good police officers. One of my first FTOs was, he was amazing. He could talk to anybody, didn't matter who they were, where they were from. He built relationships right away. I was more the Pac-Man mentality at first, right? I was so excited. I wanted to get out there and get things done. And then I realized that, man, I'm working really hard. I'm not getting a lot done. But there's a lot of other people that are working smarter than me. And it's one of those lessons. Sometimes you learn the easy way, sometimes you learn the hard way. But in the end, you know, the impact that he would have and the relationships that he built was something to behold watching it. And again, you're right. It's hard to portray that ideal image of a police officer or what that image is in the mainstream media. It wouldn't make good TV, right? So
right. But I'll tell you, it's a powerful thing for me when I was on the street and I'd go out with some juveniles that are in custody and I'd say, you know something, I was arrested. And the next thing you know, they're dropping their guard and they're listening to you. Now you're building a relationship with them and they feel like you can kind of understand what they're going through maybe. And, you know, building relationships with the people you work with and the people in the community and that own the stores. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we need to do more of, but we've always been doing it. We just haven't been getting the advertising on it.
Yeah. It goes back to what I just mentioned a few minutes ago, right? So we can be busy, but not effective. And right. Sometimes, you know, we tend to make ourselves busy and worry about what's next, rather than spending a little bit of time in the moment and making a difference in the moment that you have. And maybe that's a good segue to talk about some of the things that we were chatting on before we got on the recording call here. You know, it's, you know, policing, the core of policing is really the same. It's not changed a whole lot, right? We have, you know, we have laws that society makes, we have expectations for, you know, what societal norms are, and those things are always in flux, they're always changing. And then we have the police. And if you think about that from the Peelian perspective, that, you know, the police are, you know, members of the public, and the public and they're the paid members of the public to go out and enforce those society norms and rules. Sometimes we lose sight of that, but maybe let's talk a little bit about your experiences once you became a supervisor and some of the things that started to impact you personally in your career.
So once I became a supervisor, I was working night shift, and I just went through a real hard time in my life. I had a divorce. My wife just came home and told me she wanted to get a divorce, and working a lot of hours and stuff like that. And so I had a little bit of pain going on, and I did what every law enforcement, most law enforcement do. And they don't say anything to anybody. They don't really tell anybody about it. And I just kind of kept coming to work and managed to work through that. And shortly after that, I had an officer involved shooting. A real tragic shooting took place here in the city. And not only did it affect me greatly, but it affected the entire city. I mean, it was a national news incident. Still causes a lot of pain here in the community to this day, several years ago. But it forced me at that point to go speak to a life coach and learn some things about myself. And my wife that I'm married to now set me up with somebody, and I started learning about things like meditation and breathing techniques and just expressing yourself and talking through things. I'm real glad I did it, because the fact that being arrested as a youth, going through a divorce while working in law enforcement, being a supervisor over a critical incident like that that made national news, and also being sued afterwards and sued on a couple of other occasions, I think that it makes me a better leader, because I can relate to guys when they're going through something like that, and that we need to talk to our guys and get to know our people more. I've been blessed to work for an administration that allows us to have what we call, we were talking about it earlier, shift bids, where we allow our officers to work what shift they choose. And we do the best we can. Not everybody gets the shift that they pick. And the reason we do that is we want to build relationships with our employees. We want to serve them. We want to know them. And when you get to be a larger agency, it's hard to know everybody and to see everybody every day. But if you have a sergeant that somebody works for several years, they get to know their people. And, you know, if you're looking at their statistical data, their stats, we're not really a stat-driven agency, but we may look at the stats and we may say, well, what's wrong with John? His stats have diminished over the last couple of months. He's usually a pretty active guy. And the sergeant could say, yeah, there's something's going on with him. Let me talk to him. And
hypothetical John. We'll call him, yeah, hypothetical John.
Exactly. You know, there are,
I don't know if you have a John that's working for you, but if you do have a John that's working for you, it's like, man, Major just called me out on the podcast.
Yeah, no, we don't have a, yeah. So, you know, you got to get to know your people. It's important to know your people. You got to protect your people. And when you know your people and you protect your people, my chief believes that the people will feel safe and the people will love coming to work. And that's the environment that we have right now in the police department. And it's really an amazing thing when everybody feels that if they do make a mistake and they get written up or they get a corrective action form, that they let you down. They let the team down, you know. And unless you have that trust with the guys, it's always going to be an antagonistic thing. You know, you're going to have to build that trust with them, build that relationship with their sergeants and have that out there.
Yeah, and that's important for the public to understand as well. You know, obviously, you know, I spent a lot of time in the profession, 10 years as a chief, and I feel your pain when you talk about lawsuits. You know, as an individual officer, I was never sued once. I was never named in a lawsuit. And as a chief, I kind of lost count. I stopped keeping track of it. You know, you're responsible for not only your own decisions, but you're responsible for the decisions that others make. And it can be a heavy burden. And it's a huge responsibility.
And guys will say to you, oh, you know, that's going to get dropped and you're going to be fine. And you can hear all that, but there's something inside of you knowing that you're carrying that and you're still going to work and you're still getting involved in critical incidents every day.
Because the work doesn't go away. It's still there.
That's right.
And you almost feel,
yeah, it's an awkward feeling. And to be able to relate to that and understand it. And then when it happens to one of your guys, to be able to call them in, tell them that you've been through it. And if they need to talk about it, I think they'll understand a little better. Or they'll feel comfortable talking to you.
Yeah. That, you know, that's an amazing relationship to have. And, you know, I looked up Mr. Google when you made a comment earlier about, you know, having gone through a divorce, and most people know this, but, you know, the police profession has a high divorce rate. You know, the national divorce rate is about 50%, but for police officers, it's 60 to 75%. It's hard to get people to understand that. And the pressures that the officers feel don't just live with them, right? And say, hey, you know, there's a common expression, you know, leave your stress at work, leave the job at work. You know, yeah, that's easier said than done. So you go home and that's a hard, a lot of the things that we're talking about, and we don't need to get into all the gory details about what police officers see and do every day, but that's a tough thing. So when you start talking about some of the resources that you're offering up to your officers and some of the things that you personally started to engage in, like the practice of meditation and mindfulness, you know, we joked about it. If you'd have talked about that 25 years ago, you might have gotten,
would be laughing at me. Some of them will be laughing at me when they hear it still.
Yeah.
Those will be the ones that, until it happens to them, then they'll understand. Right.
Yeah. Well, the, in my home office that I'm sitting in right now, right behind me, I have a, you can see the plant, but I have a meditation chair, a small meditation chair that sits in the corner that I've had for probably close to 5 years now. And then I have a little device here. Oh, maybe I can even grab it and show it to you.
Chief, you're making me feel better.
All right. I want to make you feel comfortable. And we don't get paid by Muse to do this, but I'll bring it up anyway. And who knows, maybe we'll have to call them up and ask them if they want to sponsor the show. But this is my Muse 2 headset. It's time for me to upgrade, but I'm kind of a tech geek too. So it's like, all right, I'll do some mindfulness. I'll try this meditation stuff out and see if it has an impact. And so of course, now I got to get technology to verify if it works or not.
You're into CrossFit also. So the meditation with the CrossFit kind of goes in tune. I know the athletes now, a lot of them are forming meditation techniques and stuff prior to events.
Well, performance, peak performance is a process. It really is. And, we are making light of it. But there is also a very serious aspect to this discussion, because if you, if we've been a punching bag in our profession for the last 7 years, quite frankly, I know those things, they cycle through, they cycle through new cycles and periods. But some of it is earned, right? Some poor performance that we've seen, and especially with the advent of body cameras, everything's front and center. Everybody gets to see this performance. But when you talk about, the officer that's under a lot of stress, that's under a lot of pressure, that, we don't know what those pressures might be. But they still have to go to those emergency calls. So it's important that when they show up, those calls, that they're centered, they're present, and they have the ability to focus on the task at hand. Because we all, the sad reality is also is what we do. In a moment, the job can turn deadly. It can turn deadly for the officer or people that we're engaging with. So we want officers to be at their best when they come to work. We want them to be emotionally regulated and in a position to make the best decisions they can, because that's the best thing for them. It's the best thing for the citizens that they're dealing with and their community that they're working in. And it's a win-win for everybody.
Oh yeah. Well said.
So with that in mind, you were talking a little bit about some of the wellness initiatives that you had going on and some of the things that you were offering and why. That might be great to let some of our listeners know what are some of the things that you're doing.
We formed a wellness committee where we have several officers here that have been going to all different kinds of trainings and learning about how to help officers. And as soon as an incident happens now, we immediately refer them to the committee if they want to talk to somebody, and they can pick who they want to talk to. But the Axon coaching thing really caught my eye, like we were talking earlier, because one of the things I think we're lacking with the wellness committee is that everybody knows everybody that works here that's on the committee. So some of the guys, they may not use it because they feel like there's a link to work and there's really not 100% confidentiality involved, where when I started researching the new Axon coaching, and I may want to have an officer speak to you because they're more comfortable speaking to you about something in their life, knowing that they're not going to be judged by their peers that are at work with them every day. Although we have a great program here, I think that the Axon coaching is just going to enhance it even greater, even more.
That's important. That's an important point to bring up. And without going into all the details on coaching, we can talk about some of that stuff in a bit. It's kind of that philosophy that cops trust other cops, but but they also have certain things that they maybe don't want to share with people that are, that they work with every day. Maybe they don't want to go to a supervisor. Even if they trust that supervisor to be confidential, they just want a neutral sounding board, and they want somebody that understands what it's like to walk in a policeman's shoes, because this is one profession. I know there's a lot of professions that are out there that are probably like this, but you know, policing is obviously near and dear to us. It's hard to trust that other people truly understand what you're seeing and doing on a regular basis. So it might be something just as simple as, hey, if I'm having trouble sleeping, maybe I don't want to talk to one of my partners about that, because then they might start worrying about me when I'm not really worried about myself just yet. I'm just kind of looking for some information about what I can do. Or, you know, or typically I think in the model that we've seen in law enforcement, which is, this is a good thing. I don't want this to sound like a bad thing, but you know, there has been very little attention paid to the physical fitness side of the house, like the physical readiness for officers. I mean, I think the public pretty much expects that their police officers are going to be in fit and shape and capable of doing the job, which might not always be the case for a lot of reasons, but also that, you know, that they're emotionally prepared to be able to handle the job. And in the post-Ferguson days with the Obama administration's, the 21st Century Policing Initiative, that report that came out, there was one pillar in particular that was, you know, the sixth pillar was identified as officer safety and wellness. And in that discussion, a lot of emphasis on emotional well-being, which is important. One of the things that, you know, that I would like to see maybe a little bit more, and this is where I think coaching really brings that to light, is that, you know, the emotional is connected to the physical, and the physical is connected to the emotional. Yeah. We could try as we may try to separate them, but if you're out of balance, eventually one of those things is going to raise its ugly head. And the way Murphy works, right, it's usually at the worst possible time.
Yeah. It's funny you said that, because our city's awesome too. We have a care here medical facility right on city site here that's funded by the city. So we can walk right over to the doctor's office anytime we want. We can make an appointment, we get blood work done. We now have a physical fitness standard for employment here. And we've always had a gym, like you said, but the area, just like you hit it, the emotional fitness of it, we just don't have that quite yet 100%. And I think I think we're guilty as cops as well for that, because some of the guys don't want to talk, or they always put that wall up around them, and they'll always say, well, there's nothing wrong, or I've got alligator skin, or so, you know. But I think the more and more people start opening up and showing themselves their true colors on something like this, and admit that you do have some weaknesses, and show your strengths always, but work on your weaknesses, and don't be afraid to ever admit that you had to go through something to get somewhere else.
Yeah. And coaching in and of itself can do that. And one of the things that we also talked about is, and this will probably be a theme across this podcast. I know I've talked about it on some previous episodes, and I'm sure it'll be a theme on future episodes. But in policing itself, generally speaking, we are very good at teaching the technical and the tactical competencies to get the job done. You know, what are the mechanics of an arrest? How do I, you know, recognize what state law says, what maybe a local ordinance or what case law says? And then how do I apply probable cause? How do I now affect the physical arrest by taking handcuffs? And how do I apply handcuffs? And those are things that we really focus on. And as you progress through your career, you go through a lot of different trainings. A lot of it is mandated trainings, but then you also have leadership training and things that you go through. and, you know, at the rank of major, I'm sure you've done some of those things. And as I got towards the back end of my career, one of the things that, you know, I was fortunate to recognize and have the opportunity to, you know, have some of these epiphanies on the physical side early in my career and recognize some of the danger cues and signs that police officers might have from a fitness perspective. But I started to realize that maybe we have this backwards. Maybe we're teaching things in the back half of our careers and towards the end of our careers that we should be teaching right up front. And, you know, and first and foremost, that is, how do I manage myself? How do I care for myself? How do I come to work being the best police officer that I can be today? And I don't know. Do you think that's changing in our profession?
I think it is. I think that people have been exposed now recently. And I think also there's guys like yourself and me that are starting to open up and talk about things that they've been through, and they're being a little bit more human than in the past. I think society has demanded it almost.
Well, and that's a great point, right? Because in the broader scheme, here we have this profession that we put so much responsibility on, because a police officer in a moment, they can make a decision that can take a life, and it might be required of them. And the expectation by the public is, not only do we want you to make that decision, but we want you to be perfect when you make it. And try as I might, I'm not a perfect person. I like to think I am sometimes, but I know I'm far from perfection. And that's the one thing that I know for sure, is that, even at 27 years in the profession, I always felt like there was more that I needed to learn. And even in my post-retirement days, there is more that I feel like I need to know. And I feel an obligation to share that information and hopefully, you know, impact young professionals that are coming into this job, because it's still, I think, one of the greatest jobs around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You just reminded me of something where you said, we're always going to make mistakes. I went to a class one time and the instructor was one of these like use of force experts. And he said, who's the best quarterback ever in the NFL? And guy raised his hand, Brady. And he said, Brady still throws interceptions. And he says, and the best surgeon, sometimes still people die on the table when that surgeon does the surgery. Law enforcement is always going to make mistakes. We don't have the same field every game, every incident we show up to. There's always a different dynamic. We got to train as much as we can, but we are still going to make mistakes and have ways we could have done things better on every single call that we go to.
So I think, yeah. So if we can educate the public, if we can do just a little bit better job of getting people to understand what the true stressors of the job are, what the reality of it is. I used to say, if you ever been to a county fair, like Indiana, you know, the county fairs are big, right? And at the conclusion of every county fair, you know, one of the funnest events that they have is the greased watermelon competitions. Have you ever watched a greased watermelon competition?
No.
So you get this group of kids, they're excited and they form teams and they have these obstacles that they have to go over, but they have to do it carrying a watermelon that's been dunked in like this Crisco oil greasy stuff. And try picking one of those up and carrying it and then try to go through over obstacles. That is a lot easier said than done. And I like to make that equation. Like trying to put somebody in handcuffs that does not want to be in handcuffs is like carrying that greased watermelon. Sometimes you can get it quickly and easily over, you know, if you didn't have obstacles, you might be able to get it done. But when you've got to climb over things or under things, it can get pretty. And sometimes that watermelon gets smashed and drops and you got to get a new one. But in the policing profession, you don't always get that chance. Right.
Oh, no.
And so I think that's, It's a great thing. It's a great thing that we're finally recognizing that we can do better and we have to do better. And that, you know, in this era of defund the police, you know, that, which, you know, sounds just, you know, when you say it out loud, it's kind of one of those things. It sounds ridiculous. Defund the police.
It's proven that it is almost.
Yeah. And you know, I think if you asked anybody, you know, when people say, well, we're not talking about defunding, what we're talking about is funding the other things that we need to do as a community to reduce the call volume that police are going to. And I agree with those things, but that's just a different way of saying we're going to defund. You know, diverting funds is still defunding.
Right.
If you want a professional response, then we need a professional investment. We need to be willing to spend the money on our police officers to adequately train them, adequately prepare them. I think we have this opportunity now. I think we finally see it, you know, and we're seeing it on the body cams, and we're seeing, you know, that's the body cameras are the greatest exponential learning tool that we have in policing. And it's funny to think that a lot of people, there's a lot of questions that surround the use of body cameras. Do police officers actually want body cameras? And, you know, overwhelmingly officers for a long time have wanted body cameras. I used to tell people before body cameras, like, man, the first time we put a dash cam in a car, as you know, after you use a dash cam for a while with just a microphone, you got a fixed point of view, but you know, the amount of time it saved our agency and it saved officers that I know from false complaints and false allegations, you know, that there's a huge investigative investment in every single complaint that comes into police departments. And if you can get right to the bottom of it, you know, body cameras, it's just an extension of that camera. And again, it's not a tell all, right? It doesn't tell you everything. It doesn't tell you how an officer's feeling. It doesn't tell you what their experience is showing them. There's no physical or tactile cues that a body camera is ever going to be able to catch that an experienced officer is going to be able to know, but it sure does tell a lot. And one of the things for us, you know, as we talk about this coaching philosophy, wow, it's like game night. It's like game film night. Football teams have been doing this. Athletic teams have been doing this for a long time. They've been studying film. Hey, what are we doing well? What do we need to work on? And guess what? And you made the Tom Brady analogy earlier, and the CEO of Axon Coaching, he likes to talk about Tom Brady a lot, right? He shows Tom Brady doing the 40-yard dash at the combine, which is right down the road from us here, right in Indianapolis. So, you watch that and you're thinking, yeah, that guy's not getting drafted.
He's not going to do well.
But he gets drafted, and now you have the right person with the right mindset who's willing to invest in himself, and he's with an organization that's willing to invest in him. And even the greatest have coaches, right? And so this concept of bringing coaching into policing, the life coaching, wow, you know, what a concept. And maybe, you know, I think there's probably some officers that have been doing this for a long time. I think maybe even some agencies that might've dabbled in something similar. We did some similar things in our agency, but, you know, the opportunity to really, to assign a peer law enforcement coach and have them work with police officers from around the country, I think it's going to be a game changer for us. And I know you mentioned that you personally have worked with a life coach. So maybe you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit of those experiences with us.
Oh yeah. I started going to one when I was going through a divorce, and that's what opened me up to meditation and trying things like yoga and, you know, working out harder and going to the gym and watching what I ate and just somebody that can help you get, you also got me back into college. I would say that got me to finish up my degree that I never finished, you know, now that I'm in a middle management position, and just helped me get to my goals, you know, and it's just someone to talk to, a neutral person. That's not a family member. It's not a coworker. It's just someone that you have that you can talk to every week or monthly. I speak to her now, like maybe quarterly, but it's almost like a really good friend that you can talk to that has the tools and gives you the tools that you need. in the areas. And the good thing is sometimes it's like looking in the mirror. You know, they want to do the only way you're going to fix something is if you admit to it. You admit to you that you have a weakness that you want to fix. I've had a good experience with it. That's why I'm interested in the coaching area. The body worn cameras have definitely helped that. I've had situations. I wanted to go back to that because I've had situations now that we've had complaints from the public, and I watched the body worn camera footage before I call the person back, and I say, "Wow, 99% of the time the officer did nothing wrong. But 1%, I can sit the guy down." Recently, this happened, so I show the guy the video. He falls on the sword and says, "Wow, I did misspeak to that lady a little bit. Just before this happened." And I said, "Okay, you took extreme ownership of it, and that's awesome, you know. And now, you know, maybe you have a long discussion with the guy rather than discipline. He took ownership of the way I can call the lady back. I can tell her the officer, we had a discussion, you know, verbally corrective thing, and he's not going to talk like that. And he admitted that he was a little bit short with you on that traffic stop." And so the body worn cameras, most of the time, they do show that we're right. But once in a while, we are a little short with someone, and we're wrong. And we can use that to coach our younger cops and our employees as well.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a two-way street, right? Because there's a lot of times where our officers handle themselves
perfect,
extraordinarily well under,
perfect,
under, these verbal assaults that people come after them. And I don't necessarily know that, you know, we struggled with this because there are times where we really wanted to share some of these videos publicly just to show our, you know, our community, what our officers were dealing with. But you also, you know, it's a balance because you don't want to embarrass any members of your public because, you know, this is, you know, we're catching them in their moments of crisis and their moments of need. And sometimes there's alcohol involved. Sometimes there's drugs. Sometimes there's domestic violence. There are all these things that you don't want to, you don't want to embarrass anybody, but at the same time, you really do want to defend your officers. And I don't want to get too far off the topic here on body cameras, but again, lots of conversations around this because, and there's some pretty good data that's coming out, you know. And I think one of the things that we've learned is, you know, generally speaking, does having a camera on an officer change their behavior? If you ask them, I used to ask this question to our Citizens Academy all the time. How many people want, by show of hands, how many people want police officers to wear these body cameras? Almost every hand goes up. And then I ask the question, well, why? Well, because we want to be able to hold them accountable. Okay. So let's have a discussion about that. So if you want an officer to wear a camera, you're coming from the position that your default mindset is the officer is prone to do illegal things or something outside of policy or immoral if they don't have the camera on their person. That would be the only thing that's stopping them from that. And when you bring that up, it's like, well, you know, when you say it that way, maybe that's not what I'm saying. And I like to talk about, you know, over 92% of the applicants in our agency alone, we screened out. They just didn't make it. And whether it's from a not being able to pass a written test or a physical, fitness test, primarily what it comes down to are issues of trust and integrity. And so when you point that out, then you can kind of start to educate people on the true value of what the cameras bring. And that is, you know, it's a neutral and detached view of the incident. It's the camera's not biased, right? It just tells you what was said and what was seen, provided that the conditions are correct and they're not perfect, right? So all these things, they accumulate, stress accumulates. And to go back to Tom Brady's got he has a quarterback coach, he's got a nutrition coach, and he probably has other coaches. Like most professional athletes have this cadre of people at their beck and call to be able to help maximize them. And that, and in policing, you know, it's long past due that we do the same for our officers.
Yeah. And one thing that we got to deal with in law enforcement too, that's the athletes don't so much is, reliving the event. You know, you have the critical incident, you have the tragedy happen. You have to go back and write a report. You have to go back and watch the incident on camera. Then you have to go to a deposition. Then a year later, you have to go to court. And you have to go to court again. You have to relive this horrific incident, whatever it is, critical incident, over and over and over again. And I know that definitely builds up stress for people. I bet some psychologists did a study on that. They'd find that out. That definitely isn't good for you. And it's like that with most of your arrests. You have to relive them. You have to go through them all multiple times.
The body keeps the score, right? That's a fantastic book. If you ever want to, another good book about understanding how stress accumulates and how we can do the things that we need to do to mitigate it. But, hey, let's change gears a little bit. Let's have a little bit of fun here. We're getting close to the end of our time. So I want to be respectful of your time. Because I know you and I, we could probably sit here and have this conversation all night long, but I don't know that everyone wants to listen to us talk about this all night long. So I like to think about, you know, just a couple of, a couple of fun things. Number one, what's your favorite book? What's the best book you've ever read? Can you name just one? And I don't even know if you're a reader. Do you like to read?
I'll give you two.
All right. Are we going to go fiction or nonfiction? Or just, best book overall ever?
My best book overall ever is a book called The Four Agreements. Have you ever heard of it?
I have heard of it. I have not read it, though.
Write it down.
All right. I'm writing it down.
By Don Miguel Ruiz, R-U-I-Z. The Four Agreements. And the Four Agreements are, number one, be impeccable with your word. Number two, don't take anything personally. Number three, don't make assumptions, which we as cops, we always make assumptions. And then number four is just simply do your best. And the book goes on to explain all four of those characteristics. And if you follow those four, you'll have a good, healthy life. It's a really good book. I give that to some of my guys here to read. Some of the supervisors, I've given it to them. They give it back to me and they say, wow, I got to read that every couple of years to try to reel myself back in again.
All right. So I got to touch on a couple of those before we go on to the next one, because I had a drill instructor right in boot camp. He talked about that, the don't make an ass out of you and me.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Don't assume. Right. And, there is I can see the application for our profession.
Yeah.
Don't take things personally. And that's hard to do. Right. And if you're not an emotionally regulated person, if you're not getting good sleep, if you're not, if you're not dialing in your fitness program and your nutritional program, then these things can add up. Right. And sleep is the big one. And it's easy to take things personally when you're tired and stressed out.
But so those four things definitely hit at home. I think with this job that we're into, besides regular life, just this job itself.
Sounds like I should have read that like 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I went to one of the FBI leadership classes one time too. And one of the instructors came in with books on the table and he goes, anybody in here read this book? And he held that book up and I was the only one in there that read it. And he was amazed. He's like, I'm not going to ask you any more questions the rest of the class. And I was like, all right, I'm in with this guy.
Yeah.
Second book is Extreme Ownership. Dichotomy of Leadership, the Jocko books. I like those books. I'm starting to read those. Sometimes I get a laugh from them, some of the sayings that Jocko has, but there you go. Extreme Ownership.
It's never far from me.
I like his good. It's the saying good that he uses. Example of good. I have a poster on the other side of my office of that, but I think it's important for leaders. When I got the captain's position, I kind of went on like a leadership campaign. I listened to YouTube videos of Simon Sinek, Jocko Willink, some of the top names of guys that are in leadership, and Maxwell. I would just start reading their books and watching their podcasts, and it just gives you other ideas and different tools and stuff as well. I think that's important for leaders to do that as well.
I got to tell you a funny story now. So you brought up good.
Good.
So there's good. Yeah. Well, he has another poster, and it's actually now in my, I have it hanging, a copy of it hanging here in my office at home, and it's as all your excuses are lies. And I had one hanging in my office at work, and so when you're the chief of police and you have that hanging right in, and it was actually in my foyer in my my professional.
You see a city manager office coming over and seeing that one.
Well, you know, it definitely it was not well received by some people. They didn't like it. And what I would always try to tell people is, look, you know, that's not for you. That's for me. I have to pass by it every time I come in my office, and every time I leave, I have to see it. And there's subtext on that poster that unless you actually stop and take a look at it, you're going to miss it. And the subtext says things like, I got tired. I'm weak. I don't have time. And it gives us all of these little things, but you really have to pay attention and look at it. And these are all the things that we tell ourselves.
Personal lies, your voices. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, it was a good conversation starter.
If they read the book, they would have been all right with it. Otherwise they'll never understand.
Well, our command staff, when you get promoted to sergeant, everybody gets a copy of Extreme Ownership. That's one of the books that's mandatory reading. And again, I know that we could get into this whole discussion about the militarization of the police and, you know, the warrior versus guardian discussions and arguments. But, I think we all find, you know, when you have a job that has a lot of stress and a lot of responsibility, and quite frankly, when lives hang in the balance, you know, then there has to be extreme ownership, right? You have to be accountable for everything that you're doing. And, there's no way to avoid it. And I think typically what we find is when we do have issues that evolve from, you know, into disciplinary matters, it's because we've had a breakdown in that somewhere in the process.
Yeah. And I've tried to explain that to some of my guys that when I'm disciplining you in a way, I've let down the team myself because I own patrol. So under extreme ownership, if something happens in patrol, I own it. Yep. And you work underneath that you underneath me. So that's really what extreme ownership is all about. I have to, take some kind of ownership for that.
Well, and you know, because your name's on those lawsuits, right?
That's it.
that's another way. I make light of it, but you know, that's the reality that comes with the profession and the responsibility of supervision. Don't take that responsibility lightly. Another coaching benefit, I keep coming back to this because one of the benefits of coaching is again, having a sounding board for difficult conversations that you have to have. And then to be able to speak to a coach or someone that's been in a position of supervision, that's not one of your peers, that you can have these discussions about, well, how do you have these difficult conversations with somebody that maybe you're friends with, maybe, you know, because in policing, especially in smaller or mid-sized agencies, it's not like large agencies where you get promoted, they can move you into a different precinct or, you know, a different part of the city where you're working with people that you may know who they are, but you don't have relationships with them. And policing is a little bit different in those smaller departments because, one day you're the coworker, the next day you're the boss, and you've got to be able to differentiate yourself and make sure that you're, responsible to the role that you have within the organization. And quite frankly, we're seeing the, I think the ramifications sometimes of, the environment where we might not feel comfortable, or we just don't have the skill set. We haven't, it hasn't been taught to us how to do that. We've seen now police officers that are going to prison because of decisions that somebody else made while they're present.
I don't care for, but you know, it's something that's really happening.
Yeah. The Chauvin case, I mean, that's public. We don't have to talk about the case, but we do know, and now several of those officers that were there, and some of them, were rookies, right?
They're brand new guys. Yeah. Under the supervision of NFTL. Yeah.
They don't know what they don't know yet. They're still learning. And so that can, you know, we could go back and have another discussion then about how well do we actually prepare our officers and how much time are they spending in a training environment before we're, you know, making them responsible, not only for their own decisions, but for the decisions of somebody else.
Right.
That's a tough thing. It's a tough
thing.
Duty to intervene. Yeah. And it's always been hard.
It's hard if you're with a veteran officer and you're brand new. That one guy, I thought they said he had 2 weeks or something on the job.
Oh yeah. It was, yeah. Yeah. Didn't know what he didn't know yet. But you know, at the same time, you know, you have to, you know, that's one of those gut check moments for new officers and, you know, we can screen for it. And we can do our best to try to train it and make sure people are comfortable to know that not only are they responsible for doing it, they have a moral and a legal obligation. It's the right thing to do and the hard thing to do sometimes, but it's the right thing to do. So, that's great. Extreme Ownership is, you know, provides some really good examples, in the dichotomy of leadership, great follow-up book.
I love the fact you got your guys reading that book when they get promoted. That's awesome.
So what is, what's your best fiction book? Do you like to read fiction?
I don't, but if I was going to, I'd say probably because I read it when I was growing up is The Outsiders.
That was a good one. Classic. Yeah. One of the best.
You know, it shows the different, the divide between social groups. You have the jocks on one end and you know, the kids that were smoking cigarettes on the other. I can relate to that in high school, being that I was on a football team and stuff like that. And I was kind of mixed because I had some friends that were on the other side of the tracks, if you will. And just that whole movie, I watched the movie with my kids after I read the book and my kids loved it as well. So that's probably one of the best ones I can come up with.
Tom Cruise, Ralph Macchio, Patrick Swayze. Studs.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times people don't realize how many big names were in that, but that's such a good movie. A great
Pony
book.
Boy.
Pony Boy. Yeah. The lessons from that are, you know, organizationally speaking, I think are also important too, because, you know, great, you know, every community is like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They may not have railroad tracks that run right down the middle of the town and, you know, yeah, it may not be a physical dividing line, but even in today's environment, we know there's that, you know, proverbial set of tracks. So
everybody's always talking about a racial divide, it seems like today, but there's a divide amongst people with a lot of things.
Yeah. You know? And when we police, we police for everybody and with everybody, and right. the departments are made up of those same types of mixture of community members. Yeah. I mean, it'd be boring if we were all the same. That's for sure.
That's right. And no matter which side we grew up on or what side we believe or what side, we have to put all those biases aside and all those beliefs. And we just got to be neutral and do what is right for everybody.
Okay. So moving on from books. So outside of work, what's your favorite thing to do?
My favorite thing is to go to the gym, work out, spend time with my wife and family, and to get to know people, build relationships, talk to people. I love to travel. I've got a little cabin up in a remote area of the North Carolina mountains that I frequent every couple of months. It's kind of a little go away medical meditation spot.
That's beautiful, beautiful country up there.
Yeah.
So is it close to Asheville or
it's west of Asheville, but north of Blue Ridge, Georgia, the Blue Ridge Mountains there, the Appalachian Trail runs right through there.
Amazing.
Really
amazing.
Good spot.
So do you bring your cell phone with you when you go?
I do, but it doesn't work.
Even better, man. That's awesome. I like to joke when people ask me what it's like to be retired and, you know, I joke that I took 90 days. I called it my chief detox program. But the hardest part was, you know, we tell each other, you know, this all the time, you know, leave your phone at work. You know, it's like, but you can't, you really can't. And we all know, and, you know, especially when you're in leadership positions, you don't even have to be in a leadership position, right? you get on that phone and man, your day can spiral out of control right from the start, especially if you see some bad news or something. So, you know, just for the listeners, and I'll probably talk about this a lot, but my routine was waking up before any of my kids or my wife and go up to my office and spend 10 to 15 minutes stretching. I had a routine that I went through. Then sit in my meditation chair, throw on my Muse headset and do anywhere between a 10 to 20 minute meditation. Once I got done with that, I have a little book that I would do 5 minutes of a gratitude journaling. And, you know, I had to write down at least three things that I started my day that I was thankful for, that I was grateful for. And then 5 minutes of reading. I read all the time, but in the morning, as part of my morning routine, it was, you know, find something that I thought would be meaningful, impactful. So Marcus Aurelius meditations, Seneca, the Stoics, things that it was amazing to me the difference after a couple of weeks that would have on my ability to feel like I had control of my day. But the one thing I moved away from that incessant need to reach for the phone, and you know, because whatever was on that phone, if it was really important, it was going to ring.
Right.
And if they texted me and I didn't answer right away, they were going to ring. And you know, obviously there were some times where you have to pick it up and you have to look, but most of the time it's that story that we tell ourselves that we have to, and we don't really need to, it's kind of, we want to. And because it's a habit that we formed, and you create a routine, around that can mitigate some of those things. And routine does that. And that was a game changer for me. I've always had, you know, I've been big in fitness and nutrition and CrossFit and all that stuff for 20 years. But that one thing right there, again, it was like, man, I wish I could go back. I wish I could turn back that clock. And again, some of the things that we're hoping that we can share with listeners on our podcast are little tidbits like this, and how people, you know, are using some of these tools and what are they doing to be successful. But that, you know, for a peak performance primer, that right there is setting your day up for flow, and getting your mind into the right state.
That's impactful. Cause I, you know, hear you talk through that and having gratitude, but boy, am I guilty of looking at my phone the first thing when I wake up. I will admit that, cause I want to see what happened last night, and I want to see what am I getting prepared for with my day. And it's definitely not the best thing you can do is start your day with reading some of the types of calls that we read. You know, but that's something that I could probably try. And I've heard people say that before, not to look at your phone when you wake up. It's a bad idea. And my kids do the same thing with social media. They're immediately looking at their phones.
Well, I have some Adam Gazzaley, if you've never read any of his work, Ancient Brains in a Modern World, The Distracted Mind. You know, there are a lot of great books that you can read about, you know, how technology is evolving faster than the brain is. And it has a lot of impact on police officers. But all right, let's close it up here. Otherwise I'll be going all night. So we've had a great conversation. What question have I not asked you yet that I should have? Is there anything, have we left anything on the table?
No, I'll end it with good.
Good. I love it. all
your Chief, I appreciate you, Chief. I did love to do it again one time.
Yeah, Major Anderson, I loved having you on. I really appreciate the time that you've spent, even before the recording and on here now. I definitely, I'm going to be looking you up when I come down to South Florida, and
I'll point you in the right direction, my friend.
And I'm not good enough to play in the Honda Classic, but I wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind playing a little golf one of these days down there. So
we might be able to get you a parking spot. We'll see what we can do.
Right on. All right. Thanks for being with us on the Coptimizer podcast. Have a great night. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Chief.
The Coptimizer podcast is powered by Performance Protocol. Performance Protocol brings professional executive coaching to police officers and administrators at all levels of the organization. Performance Protocol has the blueprint that will operationalize organizational optimization. It is purpose-built for today's public safety employees to help them accomplish goals and live better. What is it? One-on-one video-based coaching with officers and leaders who have been in your shoes and know firsthand what it means to live and work in public safety. The program will connect you with certified coaches who combine their years of success in the world of law enforcement with world-class training from the cabal of Performance Protocol coaches. Get the support, resources, motivation you need to live the life you want. Performance Protocol coaches are relatable, knowledgeable, and confidential. Most importantly, they get results. Why should the keys to unlocking our peak performance be reserved for just the boardroom or the playing field? Unleash your full potential today and get started with Performance Protocol. Remember, performance is the goal. Protocol is the path. Log into www.performance-protocol and learn more about how to bring this program to your agency and community.